We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dead on the air. We're dead on the air.
And welcome, you're listening to Dads on the Air for Tuesday the 8th of September 2009. We have a great show ahead of us for the next 90 minutes. Lots of issues in regards to children, parenting, fatherhood, and of course, as we're all aware, 2 days ago was Father's Day, so we'll touch on that as well. In the studio with me today, we have Mr. Ian Purdy back from his jaunt overseas.
Yeah, I'm back. All right, Phil. It's great to be back. Good to be back in the country. Beautiful summer's spring morning in Sydney this morning, and the place is looking good. It's great to be back.
It is, mate. It is a lovely day out there today, and, you know, it's certainly a good day to get out there and get amongst it if you can. Today we've got Sue Price coming on the show. She will be talking with us in regards to a survey that the federal government has put out with regard to client satisfaction with the family relationship centres. These centres have been running for approximately 2 years now, and the government really needs to get feedback on client satisfaction, whether it's helped, whether it hasn't, etc., etc. But before we go to Sue, let's talk some news.
Yeah, well, there's a lot in today's newspapers, lots to do with family issues, fatherhood, etc. Start off with an article that is in this morning's Telegraph under the heading Children and Booze, a Bad Mix. It is written, 4 out of 5 Australians think it is safe to give children and teenagers under 18 occasional sips of alcohol, Salvation Army research has revealed. But the Salvation Army said that far from being safe, this was encouraging future alcoholism. The research released yesterday showed 5% of Australians think it was safe to give someone aged 10 or under occasional sips of alcohol, 5% think it is safe for children aged 11 to 12, and 70% think it is safe for teenagers up to and including the age of 18. Major Brad Hulse said this was against an increasing body of medical research linking early drinking with later alcoholism, as well as going against national guidelines recommending children under the age of 15 have no alcohol at all. And that those aged 15 to 17 delay trying it, which sounds quite sensible to me. On this occasion, I'll have to come out in favour of the Salvation Army. I don't think giving children access to alcohol is a very good idea at all. Of course, and it's not just future alcoholism. I mean, a growing brain does not need to be interrupted by alcohol flowing through it. We all know alcohol damages brain cells, and the brain cells of children do not need to be damaged in this way.
Yeah, and totally agree with you, mate. And you know, I guess you've been in a similar situation where you've been out, you've been at parties, and you know, friends or people at that party, you see them give you know, a bit of a sip of alcohol to their younger child, and I don't know, mate, just rubs me the wrong way.
No, me too, all in fun, thinking that, you know, ha ha ha, it can't possibly hurt. But yeah, I agree, it's not a good idea. Children and alcohol do not mix.
Yeah, no, definitely not. Story here from the Sydney Morning Herald, depression found in 15% of preschoolers by Louise Hall. Almost 15% of preschoolers have abnormally high levels of depression and anxiety, and a difficult temperament at 5 months of age is the most important early warning sign, a study has found. High-strung or tense 4- and 5-year-olds are also more likely to have mothers with a history of depression than children who are not anxious or depressed. The study, published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, was based on annual interviews with 1,759 mothers about their children's behaviour from 5 months to 5 years of age.
Didn't interview any fathers on the issue?
No, well, you know, this is the way society is, mate. You know, I shake my head at it. It's just ludicrous.
Well, you think so. I mean, they're making drawing conclusions, and half of the relevant information is not included. I mean, yes, mothers' opinions and what mothers have to say is relevant, but surely fathers should be taken into account as well. They can't just say that mothers are the only indicators of child depression or child neurosis or whatever.
But also, I think you've got to come to the realisation that probably, you know, 30 to 40% of these mothers and these children, for that matter, don't have a dad around anyway.
Yeah, well, that's a shocking statistic. Is there anything in there to, you know, have they compared it with previous studies in the 50s or 60s or 30s or 20s or 1850s or something? I mean, or is this just out of the blue? Because is there a control? I mean, is there any control that we can compare it with? I mean, is it normal for that percentage?
Well, no, it doesn't go on to say much at all. It just says the team of Canadian, French, US and British researchers from the International Laboratory of Child and Adolescent Mental Health Development said depression and anxiety symptoms could be identified in infants who were fearful or anxious, worried, not as happy as other children, or had difficulty having fun. It doesn't really talk about any controls. It doesn't talk about any other studies that it's gleaning off. Nothing there at all.
Does it, what about leading on to problems as an adult? I mean, if you're an unhappy child, or depressed, or whatever, you know, terminology you care to use, does that mean that you are going to grow up to be socially disadvantaged, a depressed adult?
Well, it does say here, they quote a leading author, Sylvana Cote, who is a professor at the University of Montreal in their social and preventative medicine department, and it says that as early as the first year of life, there are indicators that some children have more risk than others to develop high level of depression and anxiety, and this normally will follow through to their later years.
So what they're saying is that it's a foundation of misery, basically, which will accompany the child through their entire life, which is a shocking.
It is, mate. It is. And, you know, I guess the positive is if they can identify these children and, you know, keep them, within their radar screens and, you know, try and cope with all these sorts of situations that this child might come up with in their general life.
Yeah, a lot of the treatment is putting these kids on drugs, which, you know, personally, I don't think that's a good idea at all.
No, neither do I, mate. Neither do I.
Okay, well, moving right along, there's this article in this morning's Telegraph. Tom Kelly has written under the heading, Trash Talk, Just a Reason to Romp, Red Hot Sex Book Reveals. Tom Kelly has written, for every woman expecting the earth to move, there are two with more practical motives. From relieving boredom to keeping the peace or curing a headache, women have sex for many reasons, but romance and passion come rather low on the list, a new book has revealed. One woman even admitted to having sex just so her husband would put the rubbish out. Research has shown most men find most women at least somewhat sexually attractive, whereas most women do not find most men sexually attractive at all. That's what Why Women Have Sex authors Cindy Meston and Davis Buss have written. So they don't find us sexually attractive at all. They find our wallets sexually attractive, perhaps.
Yeah, perhaps.
Having apparently discounted physical attraction, the 1,000 women interviewed by the Texas University professors gave a huge range of reasons for sleeping with a man. One said she did it for a spiritual experience, proclaiming it's the closest thing to God. Well, okay. But mostly the explanations were far more mundane, with 84% admitting to having sex just to ensure a quiet life or to bargain for household chores. Well, that explains why men don't tend to do that many household chores, because we don't get enough sex. One woman said, I have sex to relieve the boredom because it's easier than fighting, plus it gives me something to do. Well, there you go, very deep intellectual motivation there. While it may not come as welcome news, some women have sex out of sympathy, with one admitting, I slept with a couple of guys just because I felt sorry for them.
Well. Oh, boy. Boy, oh, boy.
Yeah. But many have more selfish motives, with financial or material rewards a major factor. In one survey of students, nearly 1 in 10 women admitted to having sex for presents. Others said, he bought me a nice dinner, he spent a lot of money on me earlier on, he showed me he had an extravagant lifestyle. And rather than love or romance, for many women, sex is just about fun. Well, I vote for that. Sex for fun, that'll do me. If anyone wants to have sex with me for fun, just, you know, contact Dad's on the air, as long as you're a woman, of course.
Oh, they're all coming through the door now.
Yeah. Oh, here comes the stampede. Oh, they're batting down the hatches. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Another article here from The Australian, 1st of September by Caroline Ovington. Mother denies access, denied access to seven children. A mother of seven children has lost the right to have unsupervised contact with any of them after they told their father she had secretly been abusing them for years. When the father asked for details, the three oldest children said the mother had thrown frozen chicken at them, chased one of them with a knife, told another to put her head in the oven, and slapped, kicked, mocked, abused the others for a long period of time, including once at McDonald's restaurant where her behaviour prompted other patrons to step in. This all came before the family court in Melbourne last week when the mother applied for all seven children to live with her. However, Judge Sally Brown said that they should live as they have since the couple split a few months ago with the father and have no unsupervised time with their mother.
Okay, very sad stuff. It is very so. In my opinion, just taking them to McDonald's constitutes child abuse. But each to their own, you know. I mean, it doesn't, you know, well, yeah, well, you know, that's, I mean, a single mother on her own with seven children, I mean, you've got to kind of look at it from her side. I mean, she must be under a lot of stress.
Yeah, absolutely,
mate. You know, and then, of course, the single father, well, he's going to be under the same sort of stress. I mean, it's not an ideal parenting situation.
That's it, you know, and you come under the radar of the family court and all of a sudden you've got other people making the decisions for you.
Yeah, no, that's a shocking situation, one that if you can possibly avoid, you should. You'd think that people who had seven children would have a more committed relationship. It seems quite ridiculous to bring seven children into the world and then basically destroy their family from under them.
Yeah, well, you know, one or seven, it's, you know, it's still heartache.
Yeah, well, look, finally here, look, this is a sad story. Gold Coast Titans player Matt Rogers' three-year-old son has been diagnosed with autism. Rogers and wife Chloe Maxwell learned their son Max was autistic several months ago. He's pretty violent, he has tantrums, he attacks me often, Ms. Maxwell said. They're now working with a therapist 4 hours a day. He sort of engages with me now, which is more special, to know when you talk to your son, he looks back at you and you are connected, while before there was just a glazed look. That's what Matt Rogers said. Of course, he represented Australia in rugby union and rugby league, great sportsman. He's had a lot of tragedy in his life. He had a terrible situation with the death of his father a few years ago as well. So our sympathies go out to Matt Rogers, who's seems to be, you know, having the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune coming his way in more than one would think was his fair share.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's just adds all that extra stress and strain and stuff. You know, it's not as if you love your children any differently or anything just because of that, but it just, you know, it's just stuff you don't need.
Well, it is a horror for any parent to have your child diagnosed with a disease like autism, you know, or any disability. I mean, yep. They are, you know, they're all, you know, that's just a horror, really, because, of course, all parents want the best for their children. You want them to grow up strong and healthy. You want them to have the best chance to have a successful, happy life. And, of course, autism is definitely something that's going to impinge on that hope for the future.
Mm.
There's one more thing here, actually. This is an interesting article under the heading Curse of Bullies. In the Telegraph this morning it is written, silence, isolation, insults and sarcasm are the most common forms of bullying in the workplace, followed by public humiliation, a report shows. The survey of more than 800 employees showed bullying was rife, with half of respondents saying they had seen it and 25% had suffered it. Bullying from managers or supervisors represented about 50% of cases, while 25% reported being targeted by fellow workers. There were almost equal numbers of male and female perpetrators and victims. Poor management was also revealed to be a major contributor to the problem, but you would have to say, with the bullying problems that have been highlighted in schools lately with the death of that Jai 15-year-old up at Mullumbimby the other week in a brawl. I mean, there's a lot of bullying that it comes out of schools, and it seems that that basically once the culture is begun, once the ball's rolling, it seems to carry on from the schoolyard and into the workplace, which is most unfortunate aspect of our culture here in Australia.
That's it. And, you know, the landscape's changed from bullying from when we were at school. You know, it used to be face-to-face stuff, and, you know, now all of a sudden they do it by mobile, they do it by email. You know, it's just crazy.
Yeah, a lot more ways. You don't have to be, you know, big and strong and kick sand in another kid's face or whatever, or, you know, punch them out behind the rifle range at lunchtime or something. You can basically do it with your phone, with your thumb, you know, texting them.
Yep, and, you know, I was at a DIDS meeting, Dads in Distress meeting last night, and one of the guys there, his ex-wife, her nephew, committed suicide last week. He was 17.
As a result of bullying?
As a result of bullying.
Oh, that's just
at
tragic.
School. Parramatta Westfield threw himself off the car park.
Oh, no. That's got to be one of the worst fears, you know, of any parent, that your child would get to a point where they simply just don't want to live anymore. Everything you put into them to try, you know, to keep them alive, to make them healthy, to, you know, get them to school on time, feed them, clothe them, and then that they just turn around and take their own life must be one of the most difficult, horrible things for any parent to have to deal with.
Absolutely. And, you know, the thing that sort of irks me a bit about this, Ian, is that, you know, this is happening, but the community doesn't know about it because of the reporting standards around suicide. You know, it's not as if you open the paper and we read, oh, you know, a 17-year-old boy suicided because of blah, blah, blah. You know, we have to hear it from family and friends, you know.
Yep.
So therefore, if the society doesn't know about it, what can society do to change it?
Yeah, well, no, that's true. And of course, a lot of the suicide figures, I mean, with fathers, separated fathers, etc., I mean, clients of the Child Support Agency, as we highlight on our website, dadsontheair.net, the number of clients of the agency who have died, and the figures are fudged. You can't really tell whether they've committed suicide. I mean, a lot of road accidents, you know, people basically driving into a tree or the front of a truck or something. It's just put down as an accident, whereas it's actually suicide, and the statistics don't reflect that.
No, they don't at all. Just before we go to a break, I've got another story here. You got another one too? No? Yep.
Oh, there's a few more. I mean, we can bring a few up. Yeah, I mean, the papers are absolutely full of stories that are relevant to parenting and fatherhood this morning.
There is. We have a special request to disseminate information about a research project. We'll be talking to Sue Price about one later on, but this is a different one. It's run by the Commonwealth Attorney General's Department. It's family violence and family law to separated parents and their children, 8 to 17 years of age. As the coordinators of the research project funded by the Attorney General's Department, they'd be pleased if we could assist to disseminate the information to clients. And what they're looking for is they're looking for separated parents and children aged 8 to 17 who have been through the family law system anywhere from 1995. So, you know, that's what, 14 years ago.
Yeah.
So there's lots of scope there. So, you know, even if you went through the system like I did, I went through the system in 96, you know, get on there, okay? Because what they're asking for is information that can help the future of family law. Now, to get onto this, you need to, there is a long web address, and I'm not going to give it to you on air because, you know, it's just going to get too confusing. But there is a phone number here, and the phone number is for the Dr. Joanne Baker, and she is in the University of South Australia. She is part of the School of Psychology, Social Work and Social Policy, who is running this research project. Her phone number is 08-830-23118.
All right, and we'll mention that again later on in the program. So if you haven't got your pen and paper, go and get one. We'll be back after this short break.
Oppressors of women, or are women the oppressors of men? A woman wakes up in the morning in a house built by men. She starts the water to boil on a stove built by men, and sits at a chair and table put there by men, to read a newspaper written in part by women, but printed and delivered by men. She nibbles some toast made from grains grown and harvested by men. Whoops! Time to take a shower. She turns a faucet handle installed by a man, and lo and behold, out comes hot water delivered by a vastly complicated water system built and maintained by men. She drives to work in a car built by men, on roads built by men, powered by petroleum, drilled and refined and delivered by men. She arrives at an office building built by men, walks to her desk, fires up her computer, and glances out her window at a city built by men, full of potential customers for her service business. Out of the corner of her eye, a table in the conference room that seems awkwardly out of place snags her attention. She strokes her earlobe. At that moment, the janitor scoots by in the hallway. "Bob, oh Bob, could you please move that table further into the corner? You're such a dear." She pins him with a delectable and utterly phony smile. Bob, oblivious to the cheapness of the words and falseness of the smile, thrilled to get any attention at all from such an attractive person, pitches right in, and as he lugs one corner of the heavy table across the carpet, she exhales a comfortable sigh. Her day has begun. She will spend the next 8 to 10 hours telling other people what to do. That's her understanding of work. This creature, who has no idea where things come from, how they are made, and has not the slightest knowledge about how the world works, has been put in charge of it, because there is really nothing else of any specific value she could be doing. If she lived in a world built by women, she would be sitting in a tent, watching her breath in front of her face, stitching animal hides. But she lives in a world built almost entirely by men. And amazingly, she has not the slightest appreciation or gratitude for that fact. She never even stops to think about it. Never stops to think that if all the things men make and do were magically removed, right now she would be plodding through a muddy swamp looking for red-winged blackbird eggs. She thinks the world is made out of proper grammar and attractive clothing and polite conversation and correct opinions, instead of rivets and concrete and copper and petroleum. From the day she picked up her first teaspoon, she has been learning how to manipulate the things men provide, as if they were put in front of her by God or Mother Nature. She has no idea what men actually do. Yet, according to her and the media she consumes, men are assholes. How long do you think this is gonna last? When I think of the men, the lumberjacks and truck drivers and paper mill workers and printers and delivery men, the men who have to get up early every morning and do very hard jobs so that Ellen Goodman and Maureen Dowd and other feminist blowhards can sit in their climate-controlled offices shitting out editorials about what assholes men are. When I think of those women walking on the backs of all those men, I want to start bombing things. Let's bomb them all the way back to the unheated tent and the muddy swamp and see what they complain about then. Maybe they'll start writing editorials about how women should start doing real work, not just office work. Here are the facts. 19 out of 20 people who die on the job are men. 4 out of 5 suicides are men. 85% of the homeless are men. Women live 7 years longer than men. 65% of America's wealth is owned by women, says Forbes magazine. Men are not regarded as equal parents to their children. Men are drafted in time of war, and women are not. Given these facts, how could anyone with half a brain possibly believe that men are the oppressors of women? Now hear this. Men are now, and always have been, the protectors and providers for women. The protectors and providers for women.
And that was a selection of the thoughts of Rich Zubati, who is the author of a book called What Men Know That Women Don't Are. We interviewed him on this program last year, or actually earlier this year. You can find out more about Rich Zubati at therudeguy.com. So if you're interested in more of that, get on the internet, check out therudeguy.com. Okay, we will be back in just a moment.
With another guy, his arms around her like it used to be with me. Oh, it makes me want to die. Yeah. Well, here it comes. Look so good together, wonder what is wrong with me. Why can I accept the fact she's chosen him and simply let them be? Whoa, well, here it comes. Holding her the way I used to do. I could see her closing her eyes and telling her lies exactly like she told me to. Yeah. Well, here it comes.
Grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child.
What do you care? It's not like you were ever there anyway.
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1-300-853-437 or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air. And welcome back. Shortly we'll have Sue Price on the line talking about the client satisfaction survey. But just before we do that, Ian.
Yes, another article here in this morning's Telegraph. Glenys Green has written under the heading Chocolate Fueled Sailor. She has packed a year's supply of Tim Tams, and this morning aspiring around-the-world sailor Jessica Watson arrives in Sydney to begin her final preparations for an attempt to become the youngest sailor to circle the globe. And there's a picture over here dressed in pink, and she's a lovely young lady. Glenys Green goes on to say, making last-minute preparations yesterday on Queensland's Sunshine Coast aboard her distinctive bright pink boat, the plucky 16-year-old said she just wanted to get going. It's been so long in the planning, I just want to leave, she said. I don't know about this idea of letting young, you know, 16-year-old kids, I mean, of either gender, you know, go out there and you know, throw themselves against the elements. I mean, sailing around the world is not safe, let's face it.
It's certainly an adventure, but, you know, there's still pirates out there on those high seas.
And well, absolutely, and she looks like she would be a prime contender for some white slavery, if perish the thought she fell into the wrong hands, which, you know, alone out there in the sea. I mean, plus all the other perils. I mean, what if her boat got hit by a whale, which does happen, or, you know, there are all sorts of things could happen. I mean, she's out there by herself. I mean, if it was my daughter, there's no way she would be going sailing around the world on her own. To me, the whole thing appears to be quite ludicrous, but what can you say?
Well, what can you say, mate? You know, it's one of those things, like, you know, it would be such an adventure. It would be, you know, once in a lifetime sort of thing. You know, you would learn so much, you would grow so much, but, you know, obviously there are risks involved.
Yeah, what if she never comes back? She just sail over the horizon. That could be the last they see of her.
That's
it,
mate. But, you know, she could also get hit by a bus on the way to the marina to jump onto a pretty pink yacht.
Yeah, well, that is true. You know, all life is risk, but, you know, it's a matter of minimizing the risk. And yeah. I think letting children, I mean, okay, it must be great to get your name in the record book as the youngest, but 16, I mean, you know, how young, you know, they're going to, you know, start letting, you know, 5, 6, 7-year-olds sail around the world to try and break the record to be the youngest. I mean, to me, there should be a switch-off point, and I just think 16, I mean, a lovely young thing, you know, just to me it seems quite ridiculous. It's my thought.
Well, you know, good luck to her, and I hope she does have a safe passage and everything goes well for her, and, you know.
Yeah, no, let's hope so. All right, do you want to get back to that survey that you were talking about before the last break?
Let's get back to that, where Sue Price will be on the line very shortly. Sue is the director for the Men's Rights Agency, and they have put together a survey in regards to client satisfaction with the Family Relationship Dispute Resolution Centres in Australia. Now, for most of our listeners would be aware that the federal government had initiated an inquiry into the June 2006 Hello. Changes into the Australian family law Hello. Legislation, which saw the introduction of shared parental responsibility, enabling the court to consider shared and equal parenting time as the first option or substantial time. All court decisions remained subject to the best interests of the child criteria. A significant part of that process was the introduction of the requirement for separating couples to seek to resolve their differences using a mediation or a dispute resolution process. The government went ahead and established 65 family relationship centres all around Australia, which have received really, really significant funding for the job that they do. And there are a number of other services providing private dispute resolution programs. I believe we have Sue with us. Good morning, Sue.
Yes, you do. Good morning, Phil. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good.
That's good. So, Sue, am I right in saying Men's Rights Agency has actually put this survey together?
Yeah. Yes, we have. In the interest of finding out what is actually happening and finding out the satisfaction level with the services that are provided, we're getting some very mixed reports back, anecdotal reports from people who are using the services. Mm-hmm. Some are very happy with the way they've been treated and the outcome that they've gained. Others are totally dispirited, yep. Totally fed up with it. And some of the problems we've observed are, you know, the length of time perhaps that it takes in to actually get get to even sitting down with a counsellor at all.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I've actually opened up the survey and started to fill it out. Just
good on you.
Yeah, so we can have a look at it.
Yeah, good. Good.
Now, obviously, as you've said, and I'm sure it's probably only early days, when does this survey close off?
We haven't set a close-off date. When we get enough figures, but we'd really like to have enough people contribute to the survey before the end of this month, so that at least we can package it together, the results together, and use it in a submission to the government about the proposed changes that they want to make.
Yep, okay. Now, just talking on a personal level, I obviously talk to a lot of dads also with regards to the family relationship centres, and I've got to say that, you know, what I've found is that when the centre first opens, it's generally pretty expedient, pretty quick. You get through the process quickly. But now that these centres have been open for two or three years, their waiting lists are just phenomenal.
Are they? Yeah, you're finding that.
Yeah, that's what I'm being told. I'm being told, you know, 4 months.
Yeah, I've heard those reports, and this, of course, is one of the reasons that prompted this study. I mentioned that to the Attorney General when we met with him at the end of June, and he was quite surprised. He actually wanted to know the names of anyone for whom it had taken 4 months before they actually got to any sort of form of a dispute resolution.
Yeah, well, I'm happy to actually supply you with those names as well. Brought it up in other forums as well, and you know, again, we are also, you know, trying to tackle this situation.
Yeah, I want to really stress that we're not trying to come to a predetermined conclusion on this.
No.
I know that we are some of the most critical people you'll ever come across when we judge that a study has been predetermined and self-serving in its questioning. That's not our intention at all. We hope that we can find some very good reports about family relationship centres, and hopefully this information can be used with whatever negative reports come back to improve the system.
Yep.
To try and put a better service in place that's going to help both the mums and dads and the children, of course.
Yep.
So the study is also open to mothers. We want to hear from them. We want their input. So, you know, if you've got any mums around the place who want to have a say about their experiences with the family dispute resolution, we'd welcome hearing from them.
Yep, no worries. Now, this survey, how long would you say? 10 minutes? 15 minutes?
About 15 minutes.
Yep.
Takes to complete. It's not complicated. It's mostly alternative answers to put in. Some of the questions have where you can put in several answers. You know, you might have described the level of time spent with the children. We've referred to the same criteria that child support uses.
Yes, I noticed that with the notes.
For their determination, we thought at least we might standardise on it somewhere along the line. The government and child support and Centrelink seem to be incapable of doing that.
Yeah.
But we thought we might try.
Yeah, no, good point, good point.
You know, things like what are the parenting arrangements of these children? You might have none. They live with both parents, still in the relationship. Mother has primary care, father has primary care. Both parents share the care, and then go on to, you know, the level of time spent with the children. We ask how did you hear about the family dispute resolution centres? We ask, did you attend, you know, government-funded one? We want to know how much you've actually spent on this dispute resolution. Then, of course, what your results are from it, as to whether you ended up with a satisfactory resolution, whether your children are in shared care, or if they're in primary care with one or the other parents.
Yep.
So it's a fairly comprehensive in that respect, but it's not difficult for people to answer. One thing I do want to stress also for them, we have asked for identification, names, telephone number, email, because we do want to be able to randomly select a number of people that we can actually ring back or email back and just qualify that they are who they are.
Yeah, I think that's very important.
Most online surveys, I think, it is one of the greatest failings that they have, that people can just get on and you know, fill in forms ad infinitum using false identities, and and you can you never know what's valid in that.
Mm-hmm.
So if people don't want to give that information, well, that's up to them. But I can assure them that it is absolutely secure. We're using a secure data transmission service.
Yep.
That information will remain totally hidden from anybody else.
Okay. And once you've got all this information, who are you going to see about it?
Well, we'll put it to the government. It's obviously on their list of areas that they're looking into, of the responses to family law.
Yep.
We also want to put in some further information about domestic violence, which I haven't done the study on this one yet, but we may put up a quick survey on that.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you're probably aware, the government has linked on to the Darcy Freeman death, unfortunately, as being the significant event of 2009, and they are using that as the excuse to re-look at the provisions in the Family Law Act that were put in place to prevent false allegations of abuse being made. And they seem to think that if they, by attaching to this particular, you know, tragedy, which is allegedly committed by the father, this is going to give them the excuse to come down hard on men only, it appears, who might murder their children. And, of course, biological fathers are the least likely person to murder children. Mothers are far more likely, and so are mothers' boyfriends.
Yeah, well, that's what the statistics yell out loud and clear.
Well, they do, and the work being done by Greg Andreessen and Michael Woods from the University of Western Sydney is brilliant. They are exposing the false myths that are being created and the information that's being set, that has been put about for many, many years, that gives a totally distorted impression of whether men are violent or aggressive, or whether, in particular, whether they're violent or aggressive towards their children. And their findings show that they're not.
Mm.
So this is sort of it's a myth-breaking exercise that we need to engage in, and we need to be telling everybody, general public, the media, that the information that they've provided to the public over the last 30, 40 years, the one in three fiction about domestic violence, notion that that men are the only ones who are a danger to their children, is absolute nonsense.
Yeah, and it is an interesting point, you know, how naive or, I guess, under-informed the general public is on these sorts of really high-level information, you know, situations.
Well, this is because the media is being captivated by the victim stories that come out of academia, out of the studies that are produced, and the women's groups have been very active in promoting their issues, which is based on a claim of, you know, we are victims of men's aggression, which is totally a falsity and a completely false assumption.
Yeah, well, you know, we're at a fundraising barbecue on the weekend, Dads in Distress, and you know, we had our posters up, and you know, save the male, you know, 5 men a day in Australia suicide. And the amount of comments that we got, like, wow, you're kidding me. Is that for real? You know, that can't be right, can it? You know, and it's just, people are just unaware of what's happening out there.
It doesn't matter what they do with it. It's like the suicide issue. They have hidden that from the general public because they have encouraged the media not to report it. And they've done that on the basis that, oh, well, you'll get copycats.
Well, that's right,
happening.
Yeah.
And I don't believe that's the case at all. I think it's purely a situation where don't report it, then nobody will know about it, then nobody will ask any questions.
Yeah, exactly.
And nobody will compare it to the death rate of car accidents, for example, and find, you know, that more men die by their own hand than by a car accident. So it's really a complete exercise in hiding the truth from people.
It is indeed.
It's the same thing that happens with child safety. We're not allowed to identify people who are involved. on the basis that, oh, well, we're protecting the privacy of the child and the family.
Yeah.
But that's not the case at all. The only privacy it's protecting or issue it's protecting is the lack of response and adequate response by the officers that work in these departments.
Indeed.
It prevents their, sort of an objective look at how they're handling the situation, because you can't discuss it, you can't talk about it. The general public don't ask for answers because they don't know there's a question to be asked.
Very difficult situation, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's up to us. It's up to dads everywhere. It's up to their other relatives, their new partners, their grandparents to start kicking up a fuss about this and saying, this is just not right, you're telling lies to the public, we need the truth out so that we can make the right decisions to protect our children, to ensure family life continues in the best way possible. If we can do that, then we'll have a much better society, because as far as I can see, society with the level of divorce rate and the dysfunctionality of the children of those divorces is heading for an absolute disaster.
And with that, we'll be back after a break with Sue Price.
Look at
Dads in Distress meet in your area every week. If you're a non-custodian parent and would like to know who to contact or just want someone to talk to, help is just a phone call away. Dads in Distress, 1300 853 437, or dadsindistress.asn.au.
We're back with Dads on the Air.
And we're back with Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency talking about the survey, the client satisfaction survey with the family dispute resolution centres, family relationship centres, FRCs. Sue, there's one of the questions which sort of rang out at me on this survey was question 41. Did the counsellor talk about the benefits of shared caring, shared parenting, the negatives of shared parenting? Yes. I think that's a really great question.
It's part of the Family Law Act that they are supposed to, I understand, as are the solicitors, and everybody is actually supposed to be encouraging shared parenting, but we're not sure as to what level this is taking place.
Yeah, and, you know, I'd certainly get mixed messages in regards to this. You know, I get some guys come in and they say, you know, even the counsellor's telling me just go with the fortnight, go with the every second weekend contact, you know. But
I don't want to presuppose anything, but it is something that we have heard. I'm hoping it's not true. But I think it may be just the soft approach rather than the old court approach that, oh, this is standard contact every second weekend.
Yeah.
This, of course, what used to be the problem before the joint custody hearing, that a chap would go off to see a solicitor and he'd be told, oh, well, look, this is what everybody gets every second weekend after school holidays.
Yeah, that's it.
So don't expect any more.
Yep, just lie down and take it.
Mm. Yeah, and then along came Men's Rights Agency and said, we asked the question, why? And that's one of the most important questions you can ask of anybody in
absolutely.
In this, say, why is that so? Why should it happen?
So. Absolutely. You know, the other thing, and, you know, obviously I obviously have certain feelings in regards to the family relationship centres, but, you know, they're run by a few different organisations. You know, Relationships Australia runs some of them, etc.
Yeah.
I hope what we will also find within this survey, or the results of the survey, is if there's any major differences between perhaps going to a relationship centre that's run by Relationships Australia versus a relationship centre that's run by Interrelate or one of the other companies, you know?
That's something that may well come out of this, and I hope we're able to identify it, because that again will give substance for us to go back to the government and say, well, look, the centres that are run by this organisation seem to be accepted as being far more fair and well established in their outcomes, whereas other ones are perhaps a little bit biased one side or the other.
Yeah, because again, it all comes back to this you know, catchphrase that's been bandied around forever, that, you know, it's in the best interest of the children. Well, you know, if that is in the best interest of the children, and one organisation is on a different page to another organisation, we need to be aware of that, yeah?
That's absolutely right, and I'm afraid I'm a firm believer that the best interests of the children lie in the care of the parents.
Yep.
And the decision-making process of parents. I do acknowledge that some parents aren't capable of making those decisions properly, and then that's when someone needs to step in.
Yep, sure.
But our problem is that we have an overall situation where 100% of parents are expected to have this sort of decision made for them.
Okay. So now, listen, for our listeners,
yes,
how do we get onto this survey?
The website it's on, I've just got to pull that up, it's www.formdesk, that's F-O-R-M for Mary, D-E-S-K.com, /, and this is a bit of a mouthful, Men's Rights Agency.
Yep, Men's Right.
No gaps, just all one word, lowercase. /form1.
Okay. And if anyone has any dramas trying to get that, they can give you a call.
They can give me a call on 07 3805 5611.
Yep. And,
or they can send me an email to admin@mensrights.com.au.
Very good, no worries. All right, well, all the best. I hope...
Thank you very much. We'll be able to give you an update before too long.
Yeah, that'd be great if we can catch up again and see how it all went.
Yes. Okay, thank you very much. Keep up the good work, guys.
Well, no, thank you, Sue. Okay.
Thanks for your time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Intense for both father and child.
We try to adjust and happy memories are fine.
It's hard to cope with a life full of stress
that's leaving us empty. Our emotions a mess.
Despite our separation, our love will not die. With courage and hope, it will keep us together. Help us to cope.
Hey, all you children, we don't see your dad. We both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice.
There will come a time before we're too old.
She'll seek out together, Dad, and the truth will be told.
We'll discover the lies that have kept us apart.
No more will they try stealing what's in our hearts.
And so we will conquer betrayal and pain. Questions of why is it so? And sooner or later, the truth we will know.
Hey, all you children, we don't see your dad. We both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice for me and for you. Hey, all you children, we don't see your dad. We both need each other to share what we have. Fathers love their children as much as mothers do. We must fight this injustice for me.
I'm doing the best I can, kids.
We love you and miss you, Dad.
Just remember, there's always two sides to every story.
They grow so fast. You have to cherish every moment.
Please, Daddy.
You have a right to be involved in the life of your child. Dad's in Distress, 1-300-853-437.
We're back with Dad's on the Air.
And we're back. Ian.
Yeah, another article in this morning's Telegraph. Support for IVF slashed. That's in vitro fertilisation for anybody who's been living in a barrel for the last 30-odd years. Sue Dunleavy writes, more than 11,000 infertile women face a financial double whammy with budget cuts to IVF and obstetric services to cost them $3,800. They will have to find $3,000 to have IVF after federal study subsidies were cut back, and they will need to find a further $800 to have a private obstetrician because the government wants to cut the Medicare subsidies. The cutbacks will also be a massive blow to 1 in 10 women who have endometriosis. And then it goes on to talk about a particular woman, Katie Riggs, 29, who has this particular condition and what it is costing her. One of the interesting things about this article is that they really only talk about the effect on women. I mean, these women presumably have male partners, the intended father, who will also be shouldering the burden of these extra costs. It's only at the top of the second column where somebody acknowledges a man in the process. My husband and I have pretty good jobs. We're paying off our own home. We have private health insurance, a very minimal debt, and we're hardworking Australians, we pay our taxes. This is Katie Riggs talking about the situation. We're not talking about people who are wealthy and who can afford these treatments. We're just average Australians trying to have a baby. The article goes on to say the budget cuts are before Parliament this week and the government faces a tough battle getting the changes through the Senate. The government said the budget cuts, which will save $257.9 million, are necessary because IVF specialists increased their fees by 290% in the 5 years after the introduction of the Medicare safety net, which provided extra subsidies. So you really got to say, this is the health professionals have caused this problem. I mean, increased their fees by 290% in 5 years. I mean, that appears to me to be exorbitant, and if that's what's sucked all of the money out of it, and now that people are having to subsidise it with their own money, that would appear to me that the health professionals are not adding to the health in a professional way. You know, that just seems like a rort, that there was more money put on the table by the government, and they've just grabbed it and run off to the bank, and as usual, the people are left. And it's a tragic situation, obviously, for people who want to have children and are having complications and require the IVF treatment. There's a poll on it in the Telegraph. It says here, vote in our poll, should IVF subsidies be cut? And you can find out all about that at dailytelegraph.com.au. There's also another article. This is on a slightly happier note here. In between the grind of nappy changes, feed and sleeps, new mothers are being encouraged to read to their newborns. Kate Sikora has written this under the heading Lifelong Book Hook for Babies. From today, babies born at selected hospitals across the country will be given their first book as part of International Literacy Day. Experts believe that reading to a baby helps boost the child's language skills. Educator Wendy Bean, who volunteers her time to distribute the books at Sydney's Royal North Shore Hospital, said babies who were exposed to books early fell in love with reading. We don't claim that this teaches them to read, she said, but by the time they go to school, they will have immersed themselves in books and it will give them a love of reading, which is definitely a positive step forward.
It is indeed, mate. I read to my daughter every night that I'm there. And she loves books. She's always searching for new books. She's, you know, just 6 and a half. She reads relatively well, probably a little bit above average, because she's just that interest, you know. It's always been there, as that article said, from a little baby.
Yeah, well, I can't say that in my case. My son, we read to him. We actually even read to him through the pregnancy. We'd sit there and read stories to him, but he hasn't actually taken a shine to reading yet, although his grandmother did send him a book recently, and we're hoping that it's got lots of skulls and crossbones and pirates and things, and we're kind of hoping that might spark a bit of interest.
Yeah, and I think that's half the battle, as you said. It's you know, it has to be relatively interesting to the reader to start with, but once that they've found that book, that's it. It's away you go. You know, I've got a 14-year-old that reads very little, and we got her Go Ask Alice.
Uh-huh.
She didn't put it down all weekend, mate. She loved it.
Yeah, well, it's a matter of matching the material to the child, and that's the difficult thing, you know, especially for a lot of fathers who you know, really, we don't have that much idea of, you know, what kids are into besides guns and, you know, for boys and you know, girly things for girls, I guess.
Barbie dolls,
whatever. Yeah, I mean, it's a bit more difficult. But yeah, no, you definitely do have to match the material, because you don't want to get them something that is above their level, even though you may think it's challenging. It might actually make them feel inadequate, that they can't read it, and it might actually put them off.
Yeah,
you don't want them to have a bad experience. You want to match it to the child so that the child does get value out of it. And the main thing is that they enjoy reading, that they get joy out of it, and that's when they will establish a habit which hopefully will stay with them for the rest of life, because let's face it, it's through reading you can educate yourself on any topic. You go to the library, you choose what you are interested in, you find books on the subject, and you basically can take over your own education.
Or
at least supplement, you know, what they're getting from school and you know, other educational facilities.
Yep. Can we talk about Father's Day?
What a good idea.
Excellent.
How was your Father's Day, Phil?
Yeah, it was good, mate. It was good. Good. You know, I had my two daughters for the weekend, came up, was woken up Sunday morning to coffee and breakfast in bed, a few little prezzies here and there, and, you know, went out in the morning, went to the markets, had a good day. So, yeah, it was good.
Well, that sounds wonderful. I was actually in New Zealand for Father's Day, which meant I was away from my son, and I tried to ring a couple of times, but he was having a sleepover, apparently, and I didn't actually get to speak to him on Father's Day, which was a bit sad, but I was there with my father, so I sort of got the other side of it. You know, my father's 83 and hanging in there. I'm still with my mother, and, you know, it's lovely to see, you know, that the marriage situation can work. It's lovely to have that model, even though in my case my marriage didn't hang together like theirs did. But it's great to see that people, you know, do take the institution of marriage seriously, and to see the tremendous benefits that they get from that, especially into old age, the companionship. My parents play bridge together. They do a lot of things together, and you can just see that. You know, that they would be lost without each other. It's wonderful to see that the institution of marriage does provide all this value in their lives, especially older, and they've gone through all of the you know, the slings and arrows of life together, and they've come out the other side stronger, their relationship intact, and it's a wonderful thing. So Father's Day is a great institution, and like I said, I didn't actually see it from a father's point of view. I had it from a son's point of view, but it's good. I think it's a great thing to honour, and Mother's Day, of course, as well, to honour your parents. That's a wonderful thing.
It is, and I was talking to, you know, lots of distressed guys over Sunday and yesterday. You know, lots of guys are very anxious about not being able to see their kids on Father's Day, and it is one of the toughest days. You know, Father's Day is really tough. Christmas.
For some situations, Christmas and Father's Day can be absolutely horrifying.
That's it. So, you know, I hope for those guys that did reach out and make contact that they were able to find some, I guess, comfort in what I had to tell them. And, you know, it's not easy, but, you know.
Yeah, it's not. It isn't indeed. No, I had a sad moment as we sat down for the evening meal. That my son wasn't there. I just had a little melancholy moment there, just, you know, that he wasn't there. But he was with his mother, and, you know, I haven't actually seen him since then. But, a melancholy moment, you know, on Father's Day. It can have a downside, and certainly when you're separated from your children, it can be quite horrifying.
You know, but on the upside of that, last night I was at a dad's in distress meeting, and you know, sitting around the circle as we do, and chatting about Father's Day and stuff, you know, and one of the comments was from one of the guys was, you know, this Father's Day was the best Father's Day that I've ever had. And I said, what makes you say that? And he said, well, you know, the last 12 years we'd been married, and I never really thought that much about it. You know, Father's Day came and Father's Day went.
You got your hankies and your socks.
Yeah, that's it, you know, and your breakfast in bed, and that was it, you know.
Bit of a ritual more than a meaningful.
Yeah, but this dad, this year, earlier in the year, I think it was around February, he separated. Now, to him, all of a sudden, he's seeing his kids, you know, sporadically every, you know, whenever mum, you know, decides, because it's still got to go through that process in the family relationship centres and stuff. But regardless of that, he got to see his children on Father's Day, and all of a sudden, the light went on for him on what an important role it is just to be a dad, you know?
Absolutely.
And sometimes we can become quite complacent about, you know, when you're in the relationship and these events, you know, roll in and roll sure. out, Mother's Day, Father's Day, the rest of it.
Sure, and you're concentrating on work and getting to work, and, you know, children can be a huge inconvenience and a lot of noise at a time when you don't particularly need it, and you don't focus on the upside of parenting.
That's right. So, you know, it was really encouraging for me to hear this father speak about, you know, how the light has come on for him, how important his role is as a dad, and how he's going to make sure that he's around and playing a significant part in his children's lives.
Well, on that happy note, we'll just go to a short break.
We're back! with Dad's on the air.
And that was Weddings, Parties, Anything, Father's Day.
Great track. Well, Philip York from Dads in Distress. I think we've just about wrapped up another edition of Dads on the Air, mate. Very fine effort on your part. That was a great interview from Sue Price. Any final comments you'd like to make before we call it a day?
No, that's it, mate. Obviously, if anyone is in distress and they need support, www.dadsindistress.asn.au, and you can find phone numbers and stuff from there.
Okay, well, this program has been recorded and will be uploaded sometime today by our very own rock and pop Peter Vandervoort, who's recording behind the scenes, working away, slaving away over a hot tape recorder. Good on you, Pete.
Good
Thanks,
on you,
mate.
Pete.
And you'll be able to listen to this program anytime from tomorrow onwards on our website, which is dadsontheair.net. That's dadsontheair.net, and you can listen to this program again if you want to. And, of course, all of our previous shows are archived on the site, so there's lots of stuff there to listen to. And we'll be back next week.
See you all next week.
Thank you. See you, Phil. Bye.
Dads on the Air. We're here 'cause we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.